You're listening to episode 9 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. Hi guys, this is a temporary placeholder for the perfect sponsor. I'm excited to partner with a company that I genuinely believe in and stand firmly by their message and products. If you're interested in sponsoring my show and you believe your brand can truly be of value and of service to me and my tribe, reach out to me on my contact page at 88cupsoftea.com and let's chat. Hey, storytellers, just a quick heads up before we head right into Joe Lazaroff's interview. We chatted for nearly 3 hours in total, so Joe's interview is split into two different episodes. Joe has worked over 500 jobs in the TV production field, mostly as a TV producer and a director. In today's episode, Joe really dives deep into what it takes to become a TV producer and shares his own experiences. If you're serious about wanting to become a TV producer or you want to progress to the next level as a TV producer, this episode is definitely for you. And for listeners who love hearing about what goes on behind the making of TV shows, you definitely want to tune in. Hey everyone, guess what? We have Joe Lazaroff here today with us. I am so excited to share Joe with you. He is this awesome producer and director that I worked with on Gossip Girl. He's always so super busy, and I really admire Joe because he is not only a successful producer and director, but also an amazing family man. So, Joe, thank you so much for being here with us today. How are you?
I'm well, Yin, and thank you for having me.
So excited to have you. So, Joe, I know there's a lot of listeners out there who are so curious about producers and what producers do and directing as well. But before we get into that, I'd love to know a little bit about the beginning, about how you got started with your career and what made you fall in love with filmmaking.
That's a good question. You know, and everybody does have their path, which is always fascinating. Every story that I've heard, I love hearing them just as you, your exploration is, it's always wonderful. And so my story is, if I go back far enough, I had no idea that this was a career. That in high school, grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, when you went to your guidance counselor, there was no guidance to say, you're very much a creative and you need to let these creative juices flow in television and film or theater. It's not like that. And there's nobody that I could look up to, no mentor type or anything, at the time at least, to guide me into something. So I didn't know until after college. I was traveling the country with a friend of mine, and we were driving, and we got to Los Angeles, and my cousin was in the business, and she had been it for a little bit, and she wanted me to move out to California because my sister had been in California, but she was in the art world. And she says, why don't you come move out here? Now that you're done with college, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going back to Memphis. I'll get into the real estate business. I'm going to be an entrepreneur, et cetera, et cetera. Next thing you know, I'm back in Memphis and I'm bored. And I called up my cousin and said, you know what? I think I'm going to move out there. What do I do? She goes, come on out. We'll figure it out. So I move out. First thing she does is she calls a friend and she goes, look, my cousin's here and would love to sit on the set of your commercial that you're producing. And he says, sure, I can't give him a job, but he can come watch. So I go to the set. I'm watching what PAs do, and I'm watching with the director and the DP and actors and props and grip. And I'm watching the whole thing. And I sat there probably 3-4 hours. And at one point, one of the PAs on the job came up to the production coordinator and said, I can't come in the last 2 days of work. I just got a job for 3 weeks. I got to take it. So she says, fine. And she starts picking up the phone. Mind you, this is the days of beepers and pagers, no cell phones. And she's trying to get a hold of anybody to come in the next day. She can't find anyone. She hangs up the phone. She goes, I can't find anybody. And I looked over at her and I said, I'll do it. And she says, have you done this before? I said, I have a college degree and I've been watching these guys. I have a driver's license. I know how to drive. I know how to take orders and I know how to clean up. And she says, okay, first job you have is to pick up the breakfasts and the coffee at Cantor's Deli, and I need you here at 5 a.m. So I took that on as my big challenge, and I said, you're going to have it. And next thing you know, I'm on set, I'm cleaning up, I'm setting up craft service. It was non-union, so you did everything. And I loved it. And what I realized was I was a professional PA. The other PAs wanted to be something else. So their hearts weren't into it like mine. I said, I want to be the best damn PA there is. And by the end of the day, I became the lead PA. We ended up wrapping out the set because they went into overtime and they didn't want to pay the overtime. So they left it to the four PAs to clean up and wrap the stage and clean it up and load up the trucks. I worked basically 24 hours my first day on the job and loved it and didn't stop PAing for a long time. That was my education. That was for me. My master's was being a PA for a year and a half or so, 2 years maybe. I don't know what the total was, but bouncing around, getting hungry, not having a job for 2-3 weeks and then working for 2 months straight and then not working for a month. And then you never knew where it was going to come from. You never knew when that call was coming, but I loved doing it.
And now from there, was it usually through recommendation from friends of friends, or did you push for it? You were kind of keeping your ears open about possible other projects.
You know what? I was doing commercials and I was very connected with a few production coordinators who did the hiring of PAs. I would basically follow them around. When they got a gig, they'd call me up and said, you know, I've got a gig. It's 2 weeks. It's 3 days. It's 10 days, whatever it is. And I would commit to these people. What happened was that my cousin was on a TV show and she said, do you want to be an office PA? And I was getting kind of tired. I said, I'd like to have a job that lasts more than 10 days. Yes, I'll do it. It didn't pay as well, but, you know, and PAing didn't pay well to begin with. But now I was at Universal Studios and I was an office PA. I worked 5-6 days a week and I saw a whole other side to things. And I saw television and how television was working. And I was kind of in the writer's area because I was taking care of the writers because it was the office. Back in the day, in the studio days, you shot on the lot and you would go out on location on your days that you had to go on location. But your home base, everything, post-production, production, writers, was all in one place. Universal at the time was a great factory of tons of shows being shot there. So I got to meet other people on other shows. So there's a lot of networking going on with other PAs. So the PAs, we would all kind of hang out. I met a lot of PAs on different shows. I think Charles in Charge, I met one of my best friends was a PA on that show. We met in the copy room when we were copying scripts, making copies. And we, you know, we bonded and we all learned from that. They've all become big time editors, producers. We've all done something. You know, we all were grunts. We were all in the trenches. We were all working long hours and getting paid nothing, going out and having a beer afterward, spending weekends together, hanging out, trying to figure out what we're going to do next. I want to be a writer. I want to be a director. I want to be this. And, you know, trying to find a path. The paths got made in different ways for each of us, which is very interesting.
Tell us a little bit more about your specific path. How did you get from working in the office to then producing?
What happened was I started to follow, again, my cousin was on the show, but she was in post-production. When I was done with work around 8 or 9, they were still going in post. And so I would go hang out and I would watch what they were doing in post, and I really liked it. I liked the editing process and the color correction and titles, music spotting, the mix, the final mix, ADR. It was fascinating to me. And so what they said was, well, if the show goes a second season, we'll make you a post-production PA. Show didn't go a second season, but the line producer got another show, and he said, I'll introduce you to the guy who's running post and maybe he'll hire you. And he did. And the two of us, it was a big show because there were only two people in post-production. I was the post PA, but I was also acting coordinator and supervisor because there was none. I was really, again, thrown into the trenches and had to do it. And he trusted me. I was lucky that he did trust me. And I gave him good reason to trust me because I didn't let him down. I didn't leave early. I realized this is something I want to do and I want to do well. And I don't want to fail because if I fail, I'm going back to Memphis and, you know, I mean, life will be fine. But I wanted this to be my career. that's when I realized that this was fun. This was exciting, you know, and I'm meeting lots of interesting people, and from actors and directors and wardrobe people and makeup and hair, other PAs. I mean, everybody was interesting because they were all into the same thing, this creativity. So what happened was I did that. And then I took a little sidetrack because I didn't get a job after that. The show was canceled. I ended up working at ICM on a desk for an agent. And some of the people that I'm talking about, trajectories of people, some of the people that were assistants at these agencies, one of them was, it became the president of Disney. A lot of people became huge agents, managers, and then some people fall out of the business. It's kind of like me. I was pre-med for a month and I got weeded out. And it's the same thing. I think this business will weed you out if you don't want to do it or don't have the wherewithal. You know, there's certain things, especially in like the PA world, you're not paid enough and you work your butt off. It's rigorous work and nobody really respects you. At least so you feel. A lot of people do, but you just feel like they look at you and they go, all right, get me my cup of coffee and get out of the room. But you have to be able to look the other way and say, okay, that's fine. I'm still learning things. Maybe they don't want me in the room now, but I'm going to try to get myself to say, can I sit in this room and I'll be quiet? I'll never say a word. And it's after I've done all my duties that you expect me to do. What I would do is the biggest thing that I always suggest to people is I would always look at the person who was above me. And I would say, what is it that you don't want to do right now? What is the crap work for you, the busy work? Let me do that for you. I don't want any credit. I just want to try it. I want to see if I can do it. And people started giving me great responsibilities for me in my position, but it was their junk. And I went to different departments and I'd say, do you need me to, I went to locations. I would go to the production coordinator. I would go, you know, different departments and say, you got anything you need done? Any filing, any runs, you know, locations say, I need photos of this area. Can you drive out? And I say, yeah, I've got 3 hours I can kill. I'll go drive and take photos of a location for you. It was that type of thing. And it paid off because people get bumped up because they looked good. And then they said, you know what? I want you to take the job I had. It actually worked out. I didn't realize, but I was doing it just to learn. And it actually helped me network to get better jobs. And then I got on a show. So I did ICM for 5 months. I couldn't stand it. I hated it. What else did I do? I was an assistant to a director, Dean Pariseau.
And how was that?
He was a great guy. It was difficult only that it wasn't like we were in development. We were actually filming. So my job was to get him up in the morning, drive him to work, make sure he was fed and get him home. So I learned a lot because I was on set and I was watching and, you know, because I was the director's assistant, then I got to sit at the dinners with the cast and, you know, schmooze and all of that. But I didn't do anything really. But I got to see what a director did. Finally, what happened was I got a call again from my cousin, Cheryl Block, who is awesome. She's always been in my corner. She's been my mentor, my advocate, and she's my angel and she's family. She says, I've got another show with the same guys that I was a PA. You know, she continued with the same group of people. It was Josh Brandon, John Falsey. And they said, it's a new show. It's called Northern Exposure. You can come and be a post-production coordinator on that. So the good thing about it was I took the job. I was a post-production coordinator and the show went for 5 years. So in the 5 years, I was able to grow with the show and become an associate producer. And that's what happens, I think, with anybody. If you stay on a job long enough and they like you, they will keep, you know, they'll promote you. I see that on every show I do now. As long as it goes for some time, you get in these small positions will turn into something if you work hard and you don't let...
And prove yourself, pull your weight.
Exactly. Pull your weight and more.
You sound like someone who doesn't just do what they're told and you create your own opportunities. Take a chance. Like, you have balls to say that. It's like, hey, if there's something you don't want to do, I'll do it. That takes guts to say.
Yeah. And I tell that now as a producer and a director, I tell that to especially the PAs that I run across and office people. I say, don't just sit there. And now, you know, in the day, we didn't have our computers and cell phones. And I said, stop tweeting, stop Facebooking, stop doing all that stuff. Pay attention. And, you know, you keep thanking me for doing this. I want to help people. There are, I would say, 90% of producers, directors, studio executives, they want to help. They want to teach. They want to give back because they got something from somebody and to keep the business going and finding the people who, there's something inside everybody that says, you know, I gave that person a break.
Yeah.
You know, I saw something in them and you know, there's a bit of an ego trip. When my daughter does something great, I'm like, yeah, look at my daughter. I mean, I helped create that. To me, as long as your ego doesn't get in the way of your work, you have an ego. I always tell people when I'm interviewing for a job, I said, look, I have ego, but very little, and it doesn't get in the way. And that, I think, is key, because it's a lie if you say I don't have any ego. You know, we all want the pat on the back. We all want some credit occasionally. But, you know, you're not always going to get it, and you can't scream from the mountains, give me my validation.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big thing for people to know and to learn is you may do something fantastic. Go home and tell your friends and say, I did something great, but don't go to your bosses and say, did you know that I did this and this and this and this? It's like, for the most part, they'll know. It'll eventually come around that you know what you're doing. As long as you feel confident that you did the right thing, that you did it better than anybody else could have done it, or just as good as anybody, you're way ahead of the game. And it's really keeping your ego in check.
You mentioned that you were 5 years on Northern Exposure and then was promoted to associate producer, correct?
Correct.
Feel like producers, it's still a huge mystery to a lot of people. I feel like there's so many different ways that people become producers and really like different responsibilities and roles.
There are.
So a lot of times it's very confusing. And when people are like, oh, I want to be a producer, then I hear someone else who also wants to be a producer. But I feel like their intentions and hopes of wanting to be a producer is totally different from each other. So some are talking specifically about creative input and others are talking about wanting to run the show and others are wanting to do like line producing. So can you uncover a little bit of this mystery of producers and their roles and responsibilities? I know that you said you worked your ass off, which is why you were promoted, deservingly so. Can we dive a little bit more into the responsibilities of producers?
Sure. Yes, it's vast. Sometimes producers are just money people, as we've seen in independent movies. You know, someone who put, they just do it because they want to give themselves a producer credit and they buy it. It's totally fine. It's totally part of it. But in television, it's different. So I can speak more towards television since that's my forte. As an associate producer, I was in charge of a lot of aspects of post-production. I was not the final say in post-production, but I had a lot of responsibility. And with that responsibility came a producer title because I was responsible for, I flew up to Seattle and I directed the ADR sessions with all the actors. And we had a lot of ADR. I mean, a lot. The executive producers, I'll try to help you with that one. The executive producer, showrunner. There are lots of executive producers, but the one that is deemed showrunner or showrunners have the most responsibility of anyone. And on Northern Exposure, not only were they the head writers, but they had the final say in the editing process. They had the final say in the final mix. They had the final say of the scripts. They had the final say of who was hired, especially as directors. But then, you know, they let the people, the other producers, do their job and be responsible for their areas. So when you, as a showrunner, executive producer, you're really responsible for the tone of the show, what type of show it is, and how you present this show to your audience. And that's through casting. You know, they have almost the final say for casting. You know, what I don't say, which is part of it, is the network and studio have a say. The network usually has the final say in essence, but they too, when it's a good network and a good person at the network, they let these showrunners run their shows. But what they do is they guide them to say, look, here's who I'm trying to sell ads to. Let's turn this show into an action adventure because I'm going for men 25 to 32 and I want to sell ads to them. So that's where the network comes in, but I'll put that to the side.
Yes, gotcha.
So as an associate producer, I did post-production. As a co-producer, the same thing is usually true in television. A co-producer runs post-production. So you can have a co-producer and an associate producer, and usually they are responsible for the post-production. Then I was after Northern Exposure, because it was a hit show, everybody knew it. Whenever I took a meeting, people wanted me to do their show, so they bumped me to co-producer. So I ran around with the co-producer title for a while. And again, I was responsible for, a lot of times in shows, I was responsible for the notes from the studio and the networks. You know, I would send a cut to the studio or the network and they would give it back. And I would be the one who would take the notes and implement the notes, run it past the showrunner, but, you know, I would do it. And then we would deliver the show, final color corrections, final titles, ADR, mix, music, all of that, and deliver. And that would be under my responsibilities to make sure that the videotape in the day The videotape was delivered to the network and it made it to air without any flaws.
Wow. Okay. Huge responsibility. Got it.
Huge responsibility.
Whew.
So that's why they give you that producer title, because once, as they say, the picture is locked and the sound is locked, it still has to be finished. There's a lot of work that still has to be done. So as an associate producer and a co-producer, all those associate producer and co-producers out there know that they have a huge responsibility. And there was a point where I would sit in the editing room with the showrunner. In this case, it was Sean Cassidy. And he says to me one day, we were kind of bitching about the direction of the show and what the director did. And he's saying, nobody's there on set watching this, the directors. And we have a certain tone to the show and a certain style to the show. And some of these directors come in and they want to do something else. There's nobody there to guide the director all the time or part of the time or even some of the time. And he says, you should be sitting on set. You know what we need in post. You know what we need to have to finish the show. You should be sitting on set, which somebody came to him and said, I need somebody to help me on set in Vancouver. Do you know anyone? And Sean said, yes, I do. And he was very instrumental in my first on-set creative producer job, where I was titled a supervising producer. And as a supervising producer, I supervised production. Now, there are also a lot of writers get different types of producer credit because they get paid weekly as a producer, but they only get paid when they write a script. So the way it works in TV, there's a writer's room. Everybody's breaking story. Everybody's throwing out ideas. And then you're assigned a script. You go away. You write your script after, it's been broken out by the whole writing staff. And you break your script down. You write your script. You deliver it. And then you get your big check for that script. But because there's such a team, you can't survive off the paycheck of the script. So what they do is you get a producer title, and therefore you get paid weekly a rate, whatever that, there's no set rate. It just depends what you negotiate. So at least that way you can make a living.
And that is something the writers bring up to the showrunner? Like, how does...
Well, that happens through the studio. So when they make their negotiation, it goes to the studio. Business affairs says, all right, we'll give you a supervising producer title. We'll give you a consulting producer title. We'll give you an associate producer title. There's certain titles that they'll be given depending on the level of writer they are. I don't want to, take away from any writers that are real producers, but there are writers, most of the time, they're just in the writer's room, they're breaking story and they're writing. Very few will then do other duties, which would be either being an editorial or coming to set and being creative. A lot of times a writer will come to set on their script and they'll be there to help answer questions for the actors or for the director or for the props, wardrobe, hair. What did you have in mind when you wrote this scene?
Mm-hmm.
But they get producer credit for all the episodes, but it's because they are a part of the team. They are a breaking story. They're throwing out ideas all the time. So that's to answer what are the different producers. So a lot of times when you see tons of producers, majority of them are writers.
Okay, that makes sense.
So you have the executive producer is the showrunner. You have a supervising producer or co-executive producer, which is sort of a creative producer, like what I do, which can be in post-production or production. And it's kind of an overall watcher of what's happening and putting out fires and really guiding the ship. The director's directing and they do a great job and you let them do their thing, but sometimes they can't do it all. There's so much going on and we go so fast that certain things need to be happening in the background that if you had time to really prep a show, the director probably would be doing it, but they can't do it all in television. In features, they do, and that's a whole different ballgame. So as a creative producer, I do a lot of things. I help guide the directors. I help guide all the departments when they have a question, because there's just so many things that can come up from production design, wardrobe, hair and makeup and props. And as a producer, the question is bigger than just the episode. So it kind of falls out of the director's hands because they don't know what the next episode's coming up, what needs to be done. They might say, I'd love to put a waterfall in his bedroom. Well, it's not going to play in the next episode. So, you have to be there to help answer those, like the director may want, and it might be great for their episode. It might be like a genius idea, but you'll go, I'm so sorry, but I can't do that because it won't play in episode 10. But sometimes it's a great idea and you throw it up to the writers and the writers say, that is such a great idea and we can make that work. And that's usually you're implementing ideas and you're making sure that the good ideas come to the surface and the bad ideas just kind of get squashed. But there are no bad ideas, by the way, but the ones that work.
Got it. I remember watching you guys work on set, and it was so fluid, as if you guys have sat in a room like the day before you started shooting that specific episode, as in like running through everything. It seems so cohesive when we were on set. And I do wonder if things go on before, as sort of like prep work before you actually start shooting that specific episode.
Tons of prep work. Tons. There are sitting in conference rooms for hours going through every beat, and you sit with each department. You'll sit in a room with props. Every scene is broken down, and it'll be the director, it'll be props, it'll be the assistant director, because they got to figure, they put it on the board. They're the ones that are responsible to make sure that that communication happens so the whole crew knows. It's on the call sheet, it's on the production schedule, that anything that happens prop-wise. Then you have a production design meeting, you know, and art directors, and you sit down and you look at all the locations, and you say, all right, at this location, we got to get rid of this and this because I want to put the cameras here. And then you break down every scene with every wardrobe, you know, background, how many extras are we going to have? What do they need to wear? What if it's going to rain that day? You know, on the schedule, it's scheduled for Thursday. It looks like it might rain or snow. Should we move the schedule around? We are constantly prepping. And you're prepping even when you start shooting. You're still prepping that episode that you're shooting because it's what's happening the next day and the next day. And you got to look. You've always got to know what's coming because people get sick. Weather happens. You lose a location. So you're always, always on it. It's not, you know, once you've prepped it and you start shooting, it's done. You got to be thinking about it all day, especially as a producer. You got to be thinking about the director. That's the other thing. I want the director to pay attention to what they're doing. I'll think about the other things. The line producer is going to think about that. That's the one producer I didn't talk about. The line producer is the one that's really responsible for how we spend the money. They're the responsible for the checkbook.
So they tell you when not to go overboard or when you can have space and room to get more things that you need to get.
Yes and no. The other one, they'll go to the showrunner and they'll say, look, we're having money issues and these are where we're spending a lot of money. We can stay doing it this way, but then we have to figure out where we're going to save the money. You know, and then you give it to the director or the showrunner to say, let's adjust this so we'll have more money for that. You know, they say, we want to get a certain stunt casting. You know, we want Brad Pitt to be in this episode. Well, you're going to need, you know, an extra $100,000 for him to show up for 2 hours. And then you say, all right, I think it's worth it. So let's take the $100,000 from or $20,000 from here and $50,000 from here and $30,000 from here. And we made $100,000, you know, and moved it around. And the line producer will bring it up and come up with creative ways to do it, working with the director and the showrunner to figure out the best way to adjust the script.
Wow. Okay. That is a lot. It definitely clarified a lot of things for me.
Oh, good.
I know you mentioned you were flown to Vancouver as a supervising producer on set, correct?
Correct.
Now, from there, where did your career go from there as a producer?
So when I was doing this show, it was called Touching Evil. And the quick, funny story is I had passed all the interviews through the studio and the network, but I still had one producer that I had to meet, but he didn't have time to meet me except for the plane ride up to Vancouver. So the studio said, look, if he likes you, you'll stay. And if he doesn't, we're going to fly you back home. Just you'll stay on the plane and turn around. And the good news is he liked me and we're still friends to this day. But that was kind of a fun way to interview for a job, is sitting in first class, for 2.5 hours flying up to Vancouver to a place I'd never been. I might stay a couple of days if he doesn't like me. I'll put myself up. Don't worry. You
know? Exactly. Let me just look around, travel a little bit. So it's a win-win situation.
Yeah. I was in Vancouver and I did that show. We did 12, 13 episodes. Again, show got canceled. And then Sean Cassidy had a show and he goes, you're Vancouver? He goes, stay there. I got a show. It's coming right now. And so I stayed and I did another show up there. And I kind of felt like I was his eyes and ears up in Vancouver while he was in the writer's room in LA and post-production was in LA. The other show, Touching Evil, post-production was in Vancouver. So I still ran post-production as well as prepping. So I was working 22 hours a day and loving every minute of it. It was the biggest promotion for me. It was a big jump in terms of responsibility. And it was one of those things I was extremely afraid, but the door was open and I had to take it. You know, this was a big thing to leave my family, my wife and my daughter, and to make a decision to be in another country. Jump in the career we all knew, my wife knew and I knew. We sat down, we talked about it for a very long time. Because at the same time, I was on a show. It was a pilot. The pilot was called Desperate Housewives.
Okay.
I read that script and I said, this is awesome. But I was going to be doing post-production. And then when this other opportunity came to be in production and to make that jump that Sean Cassidy had told, was talking about, I took it. you know, knowing that the show I'm going to may fail, knowing that the pilot of Desperate Housewives might not have gotten picked up, you know, so it was kind of a who knows what's going to happen. But I knew that if Desperate Housewives became a series, I was just going to do post-production. At this point, I wanted more. So I did this job. It went very well. You know, I really took it quickly, took to it and understood what was going on because I realized Sean was right. He saw it. He said, you know what you need for editing, sound, for color correct. You know what it needs to look like. You know what performances are needed to make the show that we've decided to make tonally, what these characters are supposed to be. You can be there and help guide all the departments what they have to do in order for it all to come together. He says, you've been working post-production for 15 years. You've been putting these shows together. I put hundreds of hours of shows together. He says, you know what that's needed. Now you just have to be on set and make it work. And he was right. I took to it and I loved it. And I said, oh, right, this is even better. I can really manipulate what post is going to get and know that we can make the show that we've intended to make, that we all talked about, sat around and said, here's what this show is all about. This is the style of the show. These are what the characters should be saying. This is the message we want to give, all of that. And I was there working with these actors. Talk about a powerful cast. It was Jeffrey Donovan, Vera Farmiga.
Wow.
Bradley Cooper.
Wow.
I mean, really great actors. They're just not big, huge names, but they were awesome. So, you know, I would sit with them and we'd look at the scripts and we'd go over them and talk about them. And, you know, I was guiding. I took the reins. I led. This was one of those things. I had no idea it was in me. Somebody else saw it and someone else knew it. And I guess someone saying, you can do this. This is, you know, you. I think a lot of times people need that.
Yeah.
People from the outside see something, especially when we can't see ourselves clearly and we don't know what we want. And, you know, my wife is very good at pushing me to say, do you see this opportunity? Do you see, you know, and on that, where she says, I want you to do this. This is going to be great for you. You know, go to Vancouver. I know it's going to be tough for the family, but this is an opportunity.
Wow. What an incredible woman she is.
She is.
Oh.
And she saw it. She could see in my face, you know, when I'd come back and talk about it, how much I was enjoying it. And we created a balance, me being away and her raising her, at the time, two-year-old, kind of being a single mom. And it was very difficult. It was a difficult time.
So you were gone for all episodes, like back to back to back, of course, because they needed your guidance there. They needed you to tell them and to help make the show what it should and could be. Were there moments where you could slip away and kind of do a quick weekend trip, go back to see your family? How did that work?
I did go home on some weekends. The good thing, it was Vancouver. It's 2.5 hours and it's the same time zone. So that was helpful. They came up a lot too. You know, the fact that she was two and we made a decision that I was going to do this and that my wife would stop working, which was hard for her because, you know, she enjoyed working. But then I think when she stopped working, she enjoyed not working. And being a mom and raising a child, and that is work in itself. It's a full-time job. So, you know, it was nice that they come up for 3 weeks and I would see them when I came home and on weekends and things like that. So we made that balance work and, you know, we had to find it, especially in the beginning. And, you know, not saying it was easy, but I've been now on the road since 2003.
All right. Well over 10 years.
Yeah.
For several years, I'm sure you, like you said, it was tough. You kind of had to find your groove and the balance. And now I guess you guys are kind of the swing of things, I guess. Or do you ever really get used to it? I don't know.
Here's the good and the bad. A lot of us, me growing up, a lot of people, how we grew up is, I was lucky if I saw my dad at night. You know, he'd be home for dinner at 6 o'clock. We'd have dinner. Everybody's doing homework, doing the projects, kind of take it for granted. And you go to sleep and you wake up. Maybe my dad would wake up, make breakfast, and he'd leave and he'd be at work. I'd come home from school. He's not there. That kind of lifestyle, weekends, you know, everybody's got their plans. What I found is if I did come home on the weekend, the whole weekend was planned to be family stuff. There's nothing else that's going on. Everybody's going to be together. And the other part is when I'm not working on a show, so you, like you said, it's, I could be worked 6-7 months on a show and then I've got, you know, 5-6 months off potentially. But we know that the phone can ring and I'm off again. And so we actually make the most of it. And we really, you know, spend time together knowing that I might be gone. And so that balance is different. Like, I am Mr. Mom. Pick up my daughter from school. I take her to school. I'm with her doing homework after school. So I spend a lot of time with her when I'm home.
Oh, I love that.
You know, versus, you know, coming home from work at 6 and having a headache and let's have dinner. You know,
yeah,
it's full time.
It's invested quality time.
It's a lot of quality time. So I kind of like that. You know, it's different.
You make it count. You make it count.
That's a good way to say it. You make it count. The other good part, and especially like Gossip Girl, like what we did, my daughter going to New York a ton.
I bet she loved that.
She loved it.
Heck yes. And that was the age where she loved it too. She was already like a what, preteen by then, no? Well,
she was from 6 to 12 basically.
There we go. I mean, especially around like, I'm sure when she was like what, turning 11, 12, even 10. That's, I bet she really started to really appreciate New York even more.
Exactly. She did. And I think she appreciated it from the very beginning. And as I said, I think when she was 8 or 9, she could have gotten herself around the subway without a problem. You know, I would have never done it, but I think she could have done it. So that was fun, you know. And then the best part, you know, of that in terms of family was she would do background on days, which I know you probably, that's where you saw her. She'd be doing background. And so I got to be there and, she, you know, she'd come sit in my chair.
Yeah.
And, you know, my producer chair. And, in between, you know, and she'd be the big shot because she's the producer or the director, depending if I was directing, you know, daughter. And she'd go, instead of being rounded up with the rest of background, she could just come over to Video Village, you know. I think she really liked that. And then days that she wasn't doing background, you know, they just come visit and have lunch and hit craft service. And, you know, catering was awesome. And,
hell yeah, it was. I'll tell you that right now.
Wasn't it?
It was Henry's. Good.
Henry's was good.
Yeah. Oh my God. You are like the coolest dad. That is awesome.
So she is now Netflixing it. I think she's in season 6 now. And her friends, I think, are starting to watch it. You know, she's 13 and a half, 14.
You know what's funny? My little sisters, when I was on the show, it was end of season 1 and more of season 2. I think my little sisters were about 11 and I would not let them watch the episodes. My character's role was very tame stuff. So then it's only after they finish their homework, practice their piano. And I was like, okay, if my scene came up, then you can watch that. Everything else, nope, go back out, do your homework. None of this. No, no, no.
They're smoking pot.
Yes, they're having sex. Oh my goodness. Yeah, I think that's awesome that you held off on letting her watch it till now. That's really cool. And I bet she feels so proud to be a part of it.
Yeah, I think it's funny when she sees herself and she goes, oh, she goes, I don't remember doing that scene.
That's so cute. Oh my God. That's pretty awesome. I just checked the time. I'm going to let you go.
Stay tuned.
Yes, stay tuned.
Don't leave. Part 2 will be coming.
We'll hear from you soon.
After this commercial break.
Hi, Joe. Thank you for coming back with us.
Yeah, it is my pleasure as always.
Awesome. Thank you. I wanted to ask you what you think about producing and if it could be taught, if people can go to school. I know you said when you first started off, there was nothing out there where guidance counselors were like, okay, you are a creative person, you should try producing. None of that. Do you think producing can be taught?
That's a good question. I've helped a friend of mine. I'll guest lecture at his grad class at USC. And I meet the students and I talk to the students. And some, they're all on different trajectories in this class. They all, I think part of it's a requirement in grad school to take the producing class. But, you know, everybody wants to be writer, director, agent, packager. Depending on what they want to do, they all have to take this class. He's a great teacher because he is a working producer. He comes after work at 6 o'clock on Mondays and he teaches this class. He is giving great information. I mean, great information. And these are grad students, and I think they pick it up for the most part. I think a lot of it, though, is truly a hands-on experience. I had a conversation yesterday with a PA that I worked with in Vancouver, and he wants to produce. I think he did go to film school, but he's finding being on set was enlightening. And as he said, there's no kudos, there's no pats on the back. He's got to accept that. You know, you get them occasionally, of course, but, you know, you work so hard all day and you're on your feet for 14 to 16 to 18 hours. And no one really says anything. I try to, but even, you know, when you try, we're all in our own heads of what's going on and how we feel we're being treated, et cetera, et cetera. So to answer the question, it's probably you can get the basics in class, some basic information, but until you really see what the pitfalls are and all the fires that can happen while in production and prepping, all the things that you think, oh, okay, I learned this. But then when something happens, you say, you know what? We did not cover this in class. My friend, his name is Tim Marks, and he teaches a great class at USC. He'll come in with practical experience, especially if it's that day or that past week. He'll say, let me tell you a story of what just happened. We were scheduling this and the crane broke, the camera broke down, whatever it might be, you know, and what did we do? You know, he says, I don't even know what to do. You take your best guess based on your experience and what you've seen. But sometimes things have happened that you have not encountered. I mean, look, we do that in life every day. There's things that we're never encountered before. And how are we going to handle it? I was just watching the news today of, did you see the high school that they were doing a play and the stage collapsed?
Oh, wow.
You know, it's how people reacted. Some people jumped in to help people. Some people froze. You don't know how you're going to react in certain situations. Same with producing. Sometimes you freeze. Sometimes you know exactly what to do. And sometimes you're waiting for somebody else to take the lead and that you think knows better. I'll be in a lot of situations where something happens and I'm waiting for the director to do something and I'm waiting and you see that they're freezing and it happens. It happens to the best of us. I know I've frozen and then somebody else will jump in. It's either me or the director of photography, the assistant director. Sometimes it's the actors. They'll jump in and they'll say, hey, I've got an idea. And then the director will go, that's great. You just saved me. So producing is like any other thing. I mean, producing, it's all life experiences.
For those who just left, let's say, a corporate job, because we hear that all the time, and they realize, wow, I just spent all that time working someplace that I realized actually doesn't make me really happy. And I really want to be a producer, make a career out of it. What is your advice for those people?
Jump in. Get a mentor if you can. Somebody who's been there. Here's the big thing regarding mentors. Don't expect a job from them. Expect someone who's just going to help you and nurture you along and give you the best advice that they possibly can. And sometimes it's really good advice and you may not understand it. I know I've given some hard pills to swallow to people, you know, after kind of seeing what they've done or seeing their talent, if they're an actor or, you know, and sometimes saying, you know, maybe this isn't for you. Maybe, you know, the signs are there to say, can you hear the...
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
It'll be over in about 30 minutes. He's not going to be right in front of the window for too long, I hope. And by the way, the windows are closed.
All good.
I've seen people do it, and you got to be humble. You got to swallow your pride because you may have been the vice president of a company or you owned your own company. And then now you're being told to get me coffee, kid, you know, that kind of thing. And I have to say, I think in the 30 years I've been in the business, there's been a big shift in terms of people being nice and respectful of all ages, departments, colors, creeds, you know, whatever you want to say. There's just a better atmosphere than it used to be when people, you know, I worked hard to get to the position. Now I'm hazing you. You know, it's almost that like the fraternity situation where freshmen have to be hazed because I was hazed, so I'm going to haze you. There's a lot less of that nowadays. It still exists. People still have an ego. And like I said, and they want to beat up on somebody because of insecurities or whatever it might be. You just have to be tough and thick skinned. I think that's within any corporation, company, industry. You have to have that thick skin if you're going to make it because people will be just pooping all over you if they're insecure or they're afraid of their own job and they're afraid of their own abilities. And I see that all the time, but it's less and less. So it is having that thick skin, getting a mentor, especially if you're not going to school and you're learning from the ground up. I mean, I work with the Producers Guild and there's a mentorship program. And what we do is basically it's people already in the guild who maybe do reality TV and they want to get into scripted. Those are the people who I usually talk to because I've been doing scripted for 30 years and they've done reality for 5 years and they don't know how to get out of reality and get into scripted. And it's just advice and help. And then telling people, here's what you have to do. Now go do the hard work. Go knock on the doors, get that job, swallow your pride, learn everything that you possibly can. And you get lucky and you get unlucky. You know, look at the signs. One door closes, another door opens. I totally believe in that. I think all of us are like actors. We have to do our auditions. We're going to lose the job. We're not going to get it. And you're going to think six different things about yourself. Like, why did I lose this job? What did I do wrong? You may have done nothing or it may be everything. You've got to figure that out and then you got to adjust. And I think you can do it. I think you can go to law school, get into the film business. Anybody can.
How would the people outside of the guild reach their mentors that they want to work with? Are we talking about shooting an email? Are we talking about mailing them something? Are we talking about picking up the phone? What do you think from your advice or what you've heard with your coworkers, like how maybe people approach them and they're like, hey, that was like, you know, pretty ballsy of them. I respect them. I'd like to give this kid a chance and talk to this kid, you know?
You said it all. And you're right. Everything you just said is yes. I think we talked about everybody's got an ego. When somebody does call and say, I really respect your work. I've seen your work. I really like what you do. I'd love to sit down and have a coffee with you. If I'm not busy or I have that time, I like to give back because people did that for me. So I know what it's like. And I know what it's like to say, hey, get away from me, kid.
Yeah.
Now, I will say some people come aggressively and I think they're crazy. And then I don't want to deal with them because I think they're bunny boilers. So there is an approach for everyone. Some people, you might need to give a stronger approach, but I think letters are great. I think emails are great. I think picking up the phone. People have downtime. People are bored. You look out there and you say, again, in the news, that 19-year-old kid who was in Home Improvement who killed himself. And you reach out, you go, you know how many people would have loved to have sat with him and wanted to learn about him and made it probably would have made him feel good that he made a difference in the world. And people, you know, like I have my downtimes. Well, I'm going to hold for a second. The guy's right out the window.
Okay. He's like, hey, I want my cameo in this podcast interview. Oh my gosh, this is amazing. I love this. This is how the listeners know none of this is scripted. We just go with the flow. See?
Exactly.
There we go.
So there are writers who, think about writers. They sit in a room alone. And with somebody, when I worked at ICM and I was on a desk and I had clients, I would call up every client that I respected or saw something in their resume that I went, wow, they wrote that movie, that TV show. I'd love to just pick their brain. And you know what? They were thrilled to get out of the house, to go do something, to meet for coffee, to meet in a park, to take a walk, to ride a bike, whatever that you've kind of figured out what they're into or how much time you think they may have. You make it as easy as possible for them. And again, it's like acting. You go up for the audition and they're going to say no, but somebody's going to say yes. It's like dating. It's like anything. People are going to reject you. People are going to accept you. And you just have to know, don't get down when someone rejects you and don't say, no one wants to meet me. Because you've been there in some situation in your life where you say, why did that person not like me? Why don't they want to be my friend? And then you turn around and you go, this person's a better person anyway. One door closes, another door will open. And just go out there and get somebody, talk to people, see what they did. Just like what you're doing, Yin, is perfect. You're calling up people. Like you said, I'm sure people have rejected you or ignored you.
Absolutely.
And you just got to keep going.
You have to. That's with every job, like you mentioned. Absolutely. And it just makes it more rewarding when people say yes. It's even more exciting. It's like, yay.
Yeah. And then to finish it off is sometimes those mentors are talking to their friends. They go, you know what? We just lost our writer's assistant in the writer's room. You know anybody that would be good? And they'll go, you know what? Actually, I do know somebody. You know, that stuff happened. That phone will ring at the oddest time in your cycle of happiness and sadness.
Yeah.
You know, you could be down on yourself and you're going, I can't get a job. No one loves me, whatever it might be. And the phone rings and then it's somebody saying, you know, there's an opportunity of a job at this place. Go call them up and meet them tomorrow. And just think about those things in your life. That happens all the time. When the last thing you expected was that phone call or that email.
When I get together with my friends that I've met working in the industry, and sometimes we'll just throw out ideas and it's purely just catching up. But then we do end up talking about what we've been doing, what we want to do, where we want to be in a few years. And it turns out to be the most inspiring, productive hangout. And I find that very similar to masterminds, even though they're, I guess you could say, my level. They're around my age as well, but they're all accelerated in their own careers. And it's so inspiring. But for you, were your mentors that you mentioned that you ended up having, were they very experienced or were they around your level at that time and just had different experience to pull from to give you advice? Like, how were your mentors like?
I would say people I called and still call mentors because I still love to talk to them and still get advice, even though now I'm like, even as you were saying, we're sort of in that parallel position. I still need advice. My cousin, I still go to her for advice. I mean, she's still my rock. She's family, but she knows the business. She's around. She works kind of more in the development area. So she sees what's coming down the pipe and what I should be doing. And I'll tell her about a show and she'll say, those people I wouldn't do if you have this choice. These people would be great to work with, or that's a better show for, you know, whatever it might be. And plus it's family. So she's just supportive as all hell. So she was my first mentor, obviously. And then another guy, Steve Cragg, was on the show, and he was a producer, and he sort of took me under his wing and taught me a lot, pushed me to do things I didn't expect to be able to do. Sean Cassidy, like I said, there's a lot of people who have mentored me and have shown me and taught me really good things. Josh Brand on Northern Exposure. I don't even know if he knew he mentored me, but he taught me so much. He was just a teacher, but was always very good to me. Always had, you know, when I had a question, he'd open his door. I could sit in his office. And I looked at him, and I still look at him as the, especially on Northern Exposure, we're the top rated show. He's the top guy with his partner, John Falsey. And I could sit in his office and he would talk to me. And, you know, there were other people that he would mentor and talk to. So I guess I always looked at people who have had a ton of experience because they have a lot more to draw from. Now, I had my own, like you said, masterminds. I had my own group of peers and we supported each other and it was great. And I know that comedians do that. They all kind of, the ones that kind of do the circuit that trying to do the open mics and then they all start to expand. You know, I've watched that and I think that's fascinating too, how they all kind of grow together. Like I said earlier, I think that one of the guys that when I was at ICM, one of the assistants on a desk ended up being the president of Disney.
Yes, I remember that.
So we all supported each other and we all became something. And like I said, there is attrition. People fell out. They got weeded out of the business because they just didn't like what was going on. They didn't like Los Angeles. They didn't like the cutthroat nature that it is and they couldn't let it roll off their back. So I think it's good to have your peer group because people, especially that are already working in their assistants, they hear of jobs. When you get a job, then you'll hear of a job maybe at your workplace or through somebody else, especially in the assistant level, they all hear what's going on. And when you're working, you hear about it. So if your friend isn't working, you'll usually tell your friend, hey, I heard about this job. And then if the position flips when you're not working and your friend isn't, say, I heard about this job.
I want to tie that back to the other question about those who are getting out of a corporate job. They want to produce. Now, they have no idea where to go. Sure, they're going to reach out to mentors, but let's say they haven't heard back from them in like a month or something, and they're just feeling very stuck and they feel like, oh my gosh, what is that one move that I should do to pull myself forward to having a career as a producer? What do you advise for those very beginners, the very first step?
Unless you get really lucky, God bless you if you can get really lucky and you can get that kind of producing job because somebody came to you, they're a director and they have a script and they've never done it. And both of you go, look, let's just wing it. And, you know, you raise 20 grand and you're able to put something together and then build your resume that way. God bless you. Do it. But most people that I've seen were PAs, assistants, and have taken that experience. I've seen people who were assistants and they move around so they can see the different areas. PA was talking to yesterday. He'd been on set for about a year and a half. And I had said, you should go to an office and sit in an office and do office PA so you see what goes on there. Because that's where all the prep is happening. Get into post-production if you can, so you can see what's going on there. And then you sort of see what you like. And B, if someone sees you and they like you, then they'll start to bring you up. Because I will tell you, there are not a lot of great PAs where you see that they've got something. And when you have something, it's like, and I'll go back to acting. When you see an actor who's got that sparkle and you go, wow, they have something. It's the same with the PA or a director. I mean, with every, you know, when you know what you're looking for, people see it. And if you've got it, don't worry. It'll come to you. If you don't got it, you'll know and you'll figure out, okay, I shouldn't be doing this type of producing. But thing is, don't be discouraged. There's so many areas in the film business to go to. It's its own Sim City, if you will. It's not like you say, I'm going to be a lawyer. Well, you can be a lawyer in the entertainment industry. You can be an executive. There's so many areas to go into. You know, if you like special effects, you might be a producer for visual effects. You're still a producer, but you're producing the visual effects aspect. You might not have a producer title at the end of the day when you figure out what you want to be. But as a producer, it's like, this is what's my motto. I'm a jack of all trades, master of none. I can do everybody's job, sort of, but I'm not as good as they are. But I understand everybody's job. That's why I'm a producer. That's my take on it. Now, I know other people will say other things, but my take of the type of producing that I do is I could pretty much do everybody's job, but it just wouldn't be that good.
What was your most heartbreaking moment in your career as a producer, and how did you get out of it?
I don't think anything is heartbreaking. I would say I was a co-producer. We did a pilot. Pilot got picked up. This is more on a personal, like professionally, crap happens, you know. But this was more on the personal side because it was right after we had bought a house and the show got picked up. And I'm like, great, I got a job. But then they said, oh, we're going to have to hold off. We don't like the scripts. So they said, we're going to go down for 2 months. So now I'm down for 2 months. And I'm waiting and waiting away. I'm not taking jobs. Then they said, all right, we're getting ready to go back. And they go, we need to take another 6 weeks. And I'm thinking, okay, now I'm screwed because I'm out of the window of especially back in the day when it wasn't so many cable channels and Netflix and things like that, you were in a cycle of the networks. You start work in July and you finish in April, basically. And then they do their pilots and then they pick them up in May and then you start back in July. And it was now September. There's nothing new starting up. I had to wait. So then they said, okay, we're coming back. Came back to work. And then the day before we shot, they canceled the show.
Oh, yoy, yoy.
And now it's end of September, early October. I didn't get another job until June. And that was heartbreaking because we just bought a house. So it put us in a financial hardship. And, you know, when I'm out there trying to figure out what to do and do I take a step back? That would be a mistake. You know, I could have gone on and been a post supervisor on a show. And I'm thinking, I don't, you know, professionally, should I do that? Will people then see me as a post supervisor? And then I have to work my way back up. So I decided, I mean, that was the hard part, was to stick it out. You know, that's what I said, you know, for my wife, who thank God had a job, who had one job for 8 years and then another job for 12 years. So not used to that. And that's where I've seen families break apart because of those things. You have to understand this lifestyle. And that was the heartbreak, was when they canceled the show after having waited, then having to live for 8 months, whatever it was, without a job. And when you think you're doing really well, when you are, you're successful, you're considered a success. And people looking at you and saying, wow, that guy's got it made. It's like, no. I don't. And then the phone rings and then, you know, like you said, least expected phone rings and you get a great job.
Wow, this is good because like you mentioned, people have this perception many times where it's like, oh, it's all like rainbows and butterflies. And once you have that producer title, it's all uphill. No, it's like any other job as an artist. There's always ups and downs. It's a cycle. It's great to understand that you're still going to have to go through big road bumps like you just shared with us. And that's the reality of it. With the mentors that you worked with, what are some of the best advice or tips that you still remember till this day that you can pass on to the listeners?
God, there's so many pieces of things that were, you know, like I said, I knew nothing. Every tip and advice was good.
Where's the one that really stood out to you that you really needed to hear at that time when you were just first starting off?
You can do it.
You can do it. Okay, that's good.
Don't worry about it. You have the ability. You are smart enough, and the perseverance, you know, stay with it. Don't give up. But that's for anything. You know, so I'm trying to think if there's a tidbit of...
like an actionable type of tidbit.
And I don't think there was an actionable. You know, it would just be when I was down, people picked me up and said, just stick with it. You know, the call will come. You know, and I have to tell myself that every day now, you know, the call will come. You know, that's one thing that a lot of people never understand who have never been in the business, is the fact that, like, my sister's had one job in her life. I've had probably 550 jobs, if not more than that, because of the nature of the business. Each commercial was a new job. Each TV show is a new job. You know, I could direct 10 episodes a year. That's 10 jobs in a year. People are not used to that, because then the job is over and you're not working for 2 weeks, a month, 6 months, a year. You've got to know how to mentally and financially handle that. That's what drives people out of the business. I would say that's the biggest thing. Unless you want some type of security, you can be a studio executive or network executive. And then they usually get signed to, you know, a decently long-term contract. You have a desk job, 9 to 5, for the most part. Not really 9 to 5, but you know what I mean? It's a consistent job that you're going to go to every day, and you know what to expect every day for years and years and years to come.
From all those 500 and over jobs that you've racked up, do you have any actionable advice that you can pass on to the listeners?
No. Everything that I have said up to now is the actionable advice that I could give.
That is true. It's hard to just boil it down in one sentence.
I'm trying, and I cannot find that one sentence. I would have to start over. To answer your question, start from 000 and play until now, and you'll have your answer.
Exactly. Done and done. Hey, Storyteller Tribe. Wow, how awesome was Joe? I have the utmost respect for him, and his go-getter attitude in life is truly inspiring. The biggest thank you to Joe for his time and for sharing everything with us. Please say hi to Joe over on his Twitter account at Joe Lazarov. That's J-O-E-L-A-Z, as in zebra, A-R-O-V. Also be sure to head over to Joe's show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Joe Lazarov. And as always, it would make my day to hear how this episode has helped you in any way. So head on over to Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram and find me at 88 Cups of Tea. If you like this episode, please leave a rating and review on my podcast's iTunes page. And thank you so much for listening in.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.